Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A Facebook video shows you clearly saying something that you didn't say. Another video shows a world leader saying something explosive that they didn't say. Are we ready for that threat?
We are not ready for this threat.
Okay, so what are we doing about it? We'll tell you in about 10 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. First, though, our top story today. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced yesterday he's leading a lawsuit in 8 states and the District of Columbia to block a court action that would let people download plans for untraceable 3D printed weapons. This lawsuit is being filed in federal court in Seattle. Here's Bob Ferguson at the news conference.
The Trump administration recently chose to give access to potentially untraceable and undetectable firearms to any felon, domestic abuser, or terrorist with a laptop and access to a 3D printer.
My next guest thinks that's an exaggerated concern. Lara Smith is national spokesperson for the Liberal Gun Club. Also, we're joined by Hannah Shearer, attorney and Second Amendment specialist at the Giffords Law Center. The center tried to get a federal court to block the release of those gun printing blueprints. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Lara, what is Bob Ferguson getting wrong about a company publishing blueprints to, as he says, download untraceable guns?
Well, I think the first thing that they're getting wrong is that this isn't new technology. If you Google zip gun on the internet, you'll find out that you can go to Home Depot and for about $10 make a single shot 22 weapon from things you can buy there any day. If criminals wanted to use this technology, it's been there forever and they can use it. So the idea that suddenly that because we have 3D printers that there's this whole new technology that this is a new thing is ridiculous. As a matter of fact, zip guns were a huge issue in the 1950s. This isn't new. And it's also not new because these weapons, this idea of the zip gun and untraceable weapons, well, they're actually legal under federal law, and they have been since 1968. There's a federal law that says so long as you're not selling them and so long as the weapon has metal in what's called the receiver, which is actually the regulated part of the firearm, you can own and manufacture these at home so long as you're not a prohibited person.
Okay, so let's start there. That we'll have more to say, but thank you, Lara. Let me just bounce that part of it off of my guest, Hannah Shearer. Hannah, this is existing technology and it's legal.
Well, the part that's new is that people can assemble plastic guns, and those aren't going to be picked up by many metal detectors at government buildings, courthouses, and other sensitive places.
Well, Lara just said there would have to be metal in the receiver.
Right.
Okay. One at a time. Let me let Hannah finish her sentence, and then Lara will get back to you.
Well, under current law, the metal component doesn't need to be an integral part of the firearm that can't be removed. So it would be easy to get around that law. It hasn't been updated to reflect the current danger.
Okay, Lara, the removable metal piece, right? So how is that enforceable?
So you'd have to actually be assembling the firearm in the courthouse because there always has to be a metal piece. It's kind of an understanding of how firearms work. There has to be a firing pin. There has to be something that hits the round. Plus, you have to get the round in through the metal detector, and it's always going to be metal. Firearms fire metal rounds. They're going to pick that up. Otherwise, it's just a piece of plastic.
Let me talk about plastic. You had mentioned, Lara, that it is plastic and that guns get hot. Is that an issue for you?
It is. And essentially it renders these things nothing more than plastic zip guns. And a zip gun is essentially an improvised firearm. And most people in the firearms world are looking at these. They're not downloading these plans to be a usable firearm. They're more a novelty. And because really, if you fired more than one round out of this thing, you would melt it.
Okay.
It's very hot when you fire it. The way a firearm works is it's a controlled explosion, and the explosion, the concentration of gas in the barrel is what pushes the projectile out of a firearm. That's how they work. And so that little explosion still has to happen, and it's going to melt any of the plastics out there. So this idea that all of a sudden we have this semi-automatic multiple round sort of magic thing that fires something without explosive that doesn't get hot. That's just not the reality of what these are.
Okay, Hannah, got a plastic printable weapons as novelty.
That's simply not true. In 2013, people were able to print a plastic gun that fired 9 bullets. So this, I mean, and the technology has only gotten better since then. I mean, it's nice to imagine that this is never going to be able to do harm, but that's not true. And, you know, the other thing is that there's plastic bullets are being developed, and a single round can get through a metal detector without setting it off. So this is a concern, and, you know, there's no reason not to regulate these weapons. It makes it harder to enforce existing gun laws that everybody agrees are a good idea, like those that prevent criminals and domestic abusers from possessing firearms.
And there is some agreement on some gun regulation that we can talk about. This is not just a complete, pro-con opposition. But, Lara, I want to play just briefly. This is the concern of a retired Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives special agent named David Shipman speaking to CBS News.
I guarantee you 5-10 years from now, this is going to be a real threat to public safety.
So to Hannah's point, what about in 10 years, couldn't 3D gun technology get better and more lethal?
It could, but that technology already exists. And most people use the technology that's out there for metal because it works and it's cheaper. And it's going to remain cheaper. And one of the things that people aren't concentrating on it is that we already have all of these laws. Those are the laws we need to be enforcing, because the reality is that it's much easier for a criminal in the world we live in right now to go buy an actual good functioning firearm illegally, which those are the laws which we already have on the books. Let's start funding stopping that. Let's give the ATF more funding to enforce those laws. Let's work on things that are actually a real threat out there, because these 3D firearms just really aren't that big a threat and don't work in the way that people seem to think they do.
And Hannah, isn't another issue that this is, we're talking about not just the weapon, but the ability of this company to publish information. I mean, isn't that a First Amendment protected speech?
Well, they're not publishing information. They're not just publishing a book about 3D printing your own guns. They're publishing code that can automatically, you know, be used with a 3D printer to print a weapon. And so that's very different, and it doesn't enjoy the same First Amendment protections that just expressive content would. And I really think, like, what we're talking about is not introducing a new loophole into our laws. Like, even, you know, assuming that this isn't a big threat right now, which I don't agree with, we need to make sure that going forward it doesn't become a huge threat.
Well, my response to that is, it is actually First Amendment. It's data. You're publishing data. And the laws already exist that say if you're a criminal, you can't use this. You're not allowed to own these firearms already. So we have the legal protection out there that, you know, says, hey, look, this is the reasonable restriction on your First Amendment right for the data. But the other thing that people forget is that owning a gun is, you know, a case just came down in the Ninth Circuit, which covers Washington, that says that the right to bear arms, it's not only the right to bear arms in your house. There's a right to bear arms in public. There is a right to own firearms, so long as you are a legally permitted person to do so. There's more than one civil right here. And this is one of the things the Liberal Gun Club talks about a lot, is that we really believe that people are entitled to their civil rights, so long as they are not legally prohibited from having those. And so to say, well, you can't have this, even though there's no good legal reason for you not to, because it's a protected right, that's where you start getting into issues. It's both amendments.
Hannah, you want to respond to that?
Well, the Second Amendment certainly is not absolute. It doesn't protect all types of weapons. You don't have a Second Amendment right to possess machine guns or grenades. You know, it has limitations. And I think, you know, every piece of evidence we have about 3D printed guns is that, you know, they're going to be untraceable. They can potentially get through metal detectors. This isn't something that enjoys Second Amendment protection.
Yeah, Lara, what about untraceable? Our King County prosecutor, Dan Satterberg, calls 3D printed guns ghost gun technology. They don't have serial numbers that police can track, do they?
Well, so ghost guns are improvised weapons. And ghost guns, again, these are not new. So there's this whole thing called an 80% lower. You can go on the internet, and you have been able to forever, and you can buy what's called an 80% lower. Now, they're metal, and you can go, and you can drill holes into them, and you can make the lower receiver for any five. For AR-15s are the most common. But it's very easy to go buy these and do this. You're not allowed to sell them. It's not legal. You're not allowed to possess them if you're already a felon or a domestic violence, but you have a domestic violence conviction. All the federal restrictions apply. But ghost gun technology is not new. This technology has been out on the internet for forever. The only thing that's new is suddenly there's this idea that these 3D printed guns, which frankly aren't very good technology, are suddenly creating ghost guns as this new idea. Ghost guns, meaning unregistered firearms, have been out there. Now, I'm not saying I agree with this, but California actually already looked at this issue. And California said, well, you know what? We think it's a constitutional problem to ban unregistered firearms. So what we are going to say people can do is if you're going to make one of these, you have a certain amount of time and you have to actually go get a registration number from us to own this gun. And otherwise, then it becomes a felony. That is a much less restrictive idea than, hey, you can't publish this information at all. Information which has been out there for decades.
Okay, Hannah, there's a few points there. Lara is saying criminals can't own printed 3D printer guns, that you can't sell them, and that we could require the registration of them. What do you say?
Well, I actually agree with her that this is a pre-existing problem. It's a loophole that exists under current law that people can assemble guns in their own home from receivers, and I don't think the answer is to say that we want to introduce another loophole. I think that the solution here is to look at both issues. There's no reason that anybody should assemble a gun themselves, if they're lawfully able to possess one. And so I don't think this is like a Second Amendment issue at all. I think it's about public safety and weapons that were assembled at home have been used to perpetrate mass shootings, including most recently in California.
Lara, yeah, I mentioned some things that you agree on. You support background checks, but how would we enforce background checks for a printed gun that there's no gun store to run the check?
So this is exactly what California created, right? This idea that you have to register. There are some problems with the California scheme, but in the idea of this, sure, we would have that as a much less restrictive means than, oh, by the way, you can't print this. But I do have to say one thing. It's not a loophole to be able to print a gun. It's actually legal in the federal code. It's a specific law that says you're allowed to do this. It's not a loophole in an existing law that lets you do it. So I just want to make sure that's clear. And
let me pause there. Just for that, you're saying you want to make that clear. Hannah, are we agreed there or not that this is specifically allowed, the 3D guns, printed guns?
I'm not sure I can speak to that, but I think that it would be a mistake to say that because we're not concerned about 3D printed guns that they're actually going to work, that criminals are going to assemble them, that we shouldn't regulate them. That's what I was trying to convey.
Okay. Lara, the idea that we could require registration and criminals can't own 3D printer guns, even if it's true in theory, do you have any concerns that in practice it's just it's getting so much easier because of technology and now 3D printer technology that we could hope that people obey those selling and owning and registering laws, but boy, that's getting hard to enforce.
No, actually, I don't think it's the existence of the new technology. I think the problem is underfunding of the enforcement mechanisms we already have and lack of enforcement for mechanisms we already have. And that's one of the things, root cause mitigation. If we can get to the underlying problems here, look, the ATF has a mandate to take guns from criminals, to put people who have guns illegally into jail. And it almost never happens because they literally don't have the money to go after individuals. It was a huge issue in California with the new laws that passed here saying, hey, you have to go get these guns from domestic abusers. And literally all the courts and sheriff's department said, with what money? If we're going to look at funding, let's look at enforcing the laws we have. We have so many laws that are actually focused on keeping the criminals from getting firearms. There's so many easier ways for them than going out and trying to 3D print something that doesn't work very well, that let's focus on that instead of trying to restrict the rights of law-abiding citizens.
Hannah, is that an area we can agree on? More money for enforcement, keeping guns away from domestic abusers, for example?
Yes, I certainly support the idea that ATF needs more funding to enforce existing law, but I also think we have to listen to law enforcement who are saying, you know, 3D printed guns is opening up a whole new can of worms for them. And you know, it may be that even with more funding, they're not able to go after untraceable guns. And I really don't think that this is a theoretical problem. 3D printed guns have been recovered from organized crime in Los Angeles, for example. So, it's easy to just be in denial and say that these aren't going to be used, but I don't think that's what law enforcement experts think.
Okay, we'll see how this lawsuit proceeds. Again, Washington State's Attorney General is leading a lawsuit in 8 states and the District of Columbia to block a court action letting people download plans for these 3D printed weapons. I want to thank our two guests, Hannah Shearer, attorney and Second Amendment specialist at the Giffords Law Center, and Lara Smith, national spokesperson for the Liberal Gun Club. Thanks to both of you for educating us, giving us a couple different perspectives on 3D printer guns. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. It's getting easier and easier to fake a video, and we'll tell you the dangers and solutions to that in a moment. It's The Record, and we're live tweeting this show at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Well, here's something scary. A video of you on the internet saying things that you never said. It sure looks like you, sounds like you, but you know it's definitely not you. Welcome to the world of deep fakes. The technology to seamlessly doctor videos has privacy and security experts worried, and now Congress might get involved. Earlier this month, Republican Senator Marco Rubio gave a speech at the Heritage Foundation warning that if hackers mastered deep fakes during elections, it could be disastrous.
A constitutional crisis unlike we have ever faced in the modern history of this country. This all sounds fantastic. It all sounds exaggerated. It all sounds hyperbolic. The capability to do all of this is real. It exists now. The willingness exists now. All that is missing is the execution. And we are not ready for it. We are not ready for it. Not as a people, not as a political branch, not as a media, not as a country. We are not ready for this threat.
Yesterday, the news site Axios reported that Democratic Senator Mark Warner from Virginia has drafted policies for cracking down on these fake videos. Axios reporter David McCabe broke that story and joins us now. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me.
First, what did you think of Marco Rubio's warning there? We're not ready for this constitutional crisis, this threat. Was he exaggerating?
Well, you know, it reflects a deep fear in Washington among some people about these deep fake videos, which really can produce pretty astounding results, you know, replicating a politician's speech, Barack Obama's speech even, and video. So it's absolutely a concern that's on people's minds and a technology that I think people are starting to really understand.
Would you give us one hypothetical example of such a concerning use of deep fake videos?
Well, the hypothetical example that lawmakers have used is, imagine during a campaign, video comes out of a candidate saying something that gets them in trouble, but it turns out it wasn't them, it was an altered video. So something like that is something that lawmakers bring up, sort of as like an example that hits home. But you can imagine certainly the personal and political implications of that sort of technology.
And what is Senator Warner proposing to do about this?
So Senator Warner, in this memo that we published yesterday, and others then followed us in publishing, proposed several things when it had to do with disinformation, some of which of the kind, you know, that we just saw announced with Facebook today. But when it came to deep fakes, one of the things that he suggested was that platforms could essentially be liable in cases where a user managed to secure a judgment saying that a deepfake video, the sharing of a deepfake video about them probably constituted a civil claim, you know, defamation or sharing of private facts or something like that. And they could then bring that to Facebook and say, okay, if you don't stop the video from being re-uploaded, then I can sue you. And that would be a huge sea change because platforms are traditionally not liable for user content.
So Facebook would have to investigate these very, very convincing deepfake videos? Is that reasonable?
Well, Thunder Warner's staff, in producing this memo, essentially said that they could use hashing technology that allows services to sort of automate the process of recognizing objectionable images. Child pornography is one area where they use this. But it would absolutely put more of an onus on the platforms to take care of this, whether through automation or through, a human actually investigating these questions.
Do you think we'll talk more about deep fake videos, but, you know, we saw that Facebook stock plunge recently, all these questions swirling around about regulation. So I'm curious whether you think these ideas are a threat to social media companies like Facebook.
You know, I think the companies are certainly aware of the looming threat of regulation. They've made some changes as a result of that. You know, Facebook stock dropped, some of it ascribed at least partly to the change in their margins or the outlook for their margins based on how much more they're spending to address some of these issues, not specifically deepfakes, but different disinformation, objectionable content more broadly.
Right.
I think they are very aware of the possibility of regulation, and they're also very aware, just as security-minded folks, of the threats like deepfakes or doctored video.
Oh, yeah, so yes, social media is just a part of it. What are some other proposals from Senator Warner for dealing with deepfake videos?
Well, so for dealing with deepfakes, the big one was liability. But more broadly, it addresses misinformation in a lot of different ways, one of which is, for example, you'd have to label bots, right? So bot accounts are another example of sort of automated technology that may appear to some to be the work of a human or reality. And as a result, they say essentially you might have to have a duty to label bot accounts as bot accounts. That would be one. Another is verifying the origins of posts or pages, so that they say they are, they are. Obviously, in the case of some of this election-related content we saw in 2016, it was pages operated abroad, claiming to be pages operated by Americans. So those are the sort of things that run the gamut. But the liability for deepfakes is. Would be a real targeted strike against that technology.
Did Senator Warner identify a military threat in deepfake videos?
So, you know, he said he went even broader and actually said that the military and the intelligence community are not, the papers that the military and intelligence community are not really aware or prepared for the moment that they're in right now, that there's not necessarily enough funding going to the right things to stop these sort of threats, and that there's not enough coordination to be prepared and to assess these things.
Why are we seeing such congressional attention? We're talking about Senator Warner. We heard from Republican Marco Rubio earlier. Why is Congress focusing on fake news and fake videos now?
Well, you know, I think it's a very visceral threat, right? I mean, they can understand disinformation as a post that maybe is not what it purports to be. But the idea that someone could literally create a video of you, these are people who live their lives on camera in many ways. The idea that someone could literally create a video of you that looks exactly like you, that sounds exactly like you, just out of thin air, basically out of code, I think is very frightening to a lot of people.
Yeah, we sure have the idea that, at least I grew up with the idea that seeing is believing, and that's getting all twisted around. Do privacy advocates feel like their concerns are being addressed?
You know, I think privacy advocates reacted fairly well to some of the ideas in the paper that came out yesterday. I think there's a broader question of how data collection and privacy is addressed that is really the ball game for privacy advocates, whether or not a company like Facebook can collect your data. I think, obviously, there are privacy concerns with a deepfake or anything that purports to be the work of someone when it is not. There are concerns about the data that goes into that and sort of misrepresentation, but that's one piece of a much larger conversation.
And I've heard that some people want a formal government body to regulate and possibly break up huge media organizations. How serious is that discussion?
Well, I think among the people who want it to happen, it's very serious, but among lawmakers, it hasn't picked up much traction.
Yeah. So so a big-name Republican and Democrat agreeing on some big government actions. How soon would some of these proposed policies pass, if at all?
Well, if at all, I think not. Certainly not before the midterms in November. I think if Democrats gain control of one or both houses of Congress, you know, watch to see if some of these ideas gain traction. Obviously, Democrats are very concerned about Russian election interference. They're very concerned about privacy. So watch there and see what happens. But of course, it's complicated when you have any sort of split party control.
Finally, David, have you seen one of these or more deep fake videos? Have you seen that personally?
I have seen examples. I haven't seen them sort of in the wild. You know, I see them in articles about it or in papers about it or images.
How struck are you?
As far as I know, encounter one of them.
It's
striking.
Yeah.
It's striking what you can do with these technologies, particularly to recreate voice. You know, I think a lot of people, we think of voice as something so personal and something that really belongs to us. And then you hear, you can plug in, there are sites where you can plug in someone's voice and produce a decent sounding facsimile. So I think it's pretty striking. And I think, you know, for your listeners who might go and look this up, it will be striking as well.
Yeah. Just one example. Jordan Peele did a pretty nice job as President Obama.
Well, and you know, I think obviously we're not totally unfamiliar with the idea that someone could be impersonated, but the idea that could be materialized out of code, I think, is new to people.
Axios reporter David McKay breaking that story, reporting on ideas from Senator Warner about fake videos. David, thanks for this.
Thank you very much.
It's The Record. Seattle reached its hottest July on record this week, and if you're like our office, the air conditioning is cranked. One office where that is not happening is architecture firm Weber Thompson. 10 years ago, they built their new headquarters in South Lake Union, and they built it without air conditioning to prove it could be done. This office uses about half the electricity of a traditional office building. But how are they faring in the heat? KUOW's Joshua McNichols went to their office to find out.
It's 85 degrees outside the Terry Thomas building, and inside, it's 78 degrees. I notice you're sweating a little bit. How are you doing?
I'm fine. I did walk back briskly from a lunch about 3/4 of a mile away to get here in time for this. So that's really why I've got the glow going.
Kristen Scott is a partner at Weber Thompson, and she's fine with talking about her glow because she believes air conditioning tends to cut you off from the outside world.
You forget how hardwired humans are, I think, to really enjoy the natural environment and how much respite you take from being connected to nature, even when you're in an urban environment like a city. Those opportunities become really precious.
Connecting with nature means making some compromises, like this office has a casual dress code. People here wear shorts. Some even wear flip-flops. But you can't just take a regular modern office and remove the AC. I mean, this building was designed to stay naturally cool from its very inception. The office is shaped like a donut, with a courtyard at the center, lined with windows you can open.
And then the perimeter of the building has other operable windows.
When you open the windows on both sides, the courtyard becomes what's called a thermal chimney. It sucks up air and pushes it into the sky. That draws a breeze across the office, and it all happens naturally, without power.
When people ask, what is it like inside this building without air conditioning on a hot day? It's really like being under the shade of a big tree outside, and you've got this gentle breeze washing over you. So yes, it's warm, but it's comfortable because there's air movement.
This four-story building was built to show off these techniques. The workers at Weber Thompson are totally into it, but selling it to others has not been easy.
Have you succeeded in sort of like proselytizing this method of design without air conditioners to other offices?
I guess I have to say that we have not succeeded in having another project without air conditioning. And that's mainly, I think, because while we're very focused on sustainable design, and the new projects are also, they're larger buildings.
Meaning the office spaces are wider, which makes it harder to draw breezes across them. Also, you can't do this without the central courtyard. Most developers aren't interested or able to leave a chunk of unrentable space in the middle of their building. Climate change may be another factor. When the firm ran temperature simulations before this office was built, they estimated the office would be truly too hot for human comfort about 20 hours a year. Now, that's climbed to around 30 hours a year. One day last year, the outside temperature reached almost 100 degrees. So the firm set up a kiddie pool in the courtyard, and everybody got a popsicle.
That's KUOW's Joshua McNichols on how a downtown building with no air conditioning is keeping employees cool. Well, it looks like the heat wave's over. The National Weather Service says we probably won't get as hot as we just did for the rest of the summer. Now, earlier this week, in the middle of the heat wave, KUOW's radioactive students went and asked people, how do you stay cool? And what they found was a little perspective.
What do I like to do when to stay cool? I like to get a nice, cool, wet rag put over my forehead. I like to wear some nice pair of sandals, some mesh shorts, get the nice flow, nice airflow. Other than that, keep it cool. They have a nice, cool, ice Arnold Palmer. You know, stay in the shade, you know. Go to the park, stay in the shade, guys, you know. Keep it cool.
How does the summer here compare to the summers growing up?
Summers in Ohio kind of break the 90s, so they kind of get a little hotter than here. Summers here so far, what I've noticed, my first summer here, is going really well.
And what's different? Have you guys noticed anything different from the summer here in Seattle to the summer back at home?
It's a lot cooler here. There's more breeze.
Feels way better.
Well, like, the humidity is different here, so it's not, like, I wouldn't have my hair down now in like, Charlotte. I'd have it up and be sweating.
And it's, like, 95 degrees
feels
there.
Good here.
You know, when you're used to 95 plus with 70% humidity plus, to come out here in the cool weather at 72 degrees or whatever it is, we actually feel pretty good right now.
I grew up in the Midwest, so, you know, there it's, like, it's sticky and it's hot. Like it's 87 in the shade at 8 o'clock at night there. So, and there's bugs here. You know, it's there's some humidity here, but it gets cooled off with breezes, right? So it doesn't stay hot here. But heat to me is when you're sweating in the shade. That's when it's uncomfortable.
Sweating in the shade, that's when it gets real. So there you go, Seattle area. It's all relative. I hope you enjoy the next few days in the 70s. We were talking heat waves a moment ago. Let's talk about butterflies that we never used to see. They seem to be everywhere these days. Other butterflies are getting more scarce. What's going on? As Eilish O'Neill reports for EarthFix, scientists would like to figure that out.
Jean Bradbury lives in northeast Seattle. She's an artist, and she loves swallowtail butterflies.
So these guys are big, like we think of a monarch, like the palm of your hand. They're pale, bright yellow. Very, very beautiful.
Bradbury says she never used to see many swallowtail butterflies in Seattle, but this summer,
it seemed like I was seeing them every day.
So she posted about it on Facebook, and her friend said,
yes, it's a thing. There seem to have been more this year. I wonder, why am I seeing more?
Bradbury wrote to KUOW to ask. I went to David James to find out. He's a butterfly expert at Washington State University.
Swallowtail butterflies seem to be more common on the west side this year, in fact, for the last couple of years, than historically. They are lovers of sunshine.
So James posits, perhaps they're thriving in the warmer, sunnier summers Seattle's had for the past couple of years.
It wouldn't take, you know, a lot more sunshine to improve the ability of the butterflies to find each other, mate, and lay their eggs.
The other reason swallowtails are doing well is they like plants that people tend to have in parks and gardens.
The plants that they need to survive, they're things like willows and cottonwoods and maples. And their caterpillars need those to feed on to develop into the butterflies. And the adult butterflies need nectar plants, of which they can find plenty of in most people's backyards.
So there are more butterflies to bring happiness and joy to our lives. And I wish I could end the story there. But as always, it's more complicated. Butterflies other than swallowtails are losing habitat to cities and farms. And pollution and pesticides have also been unkind to butterflies. That means, unfortunately, swallowtails are the exception.
We do not see as many butterflies flying around as we used to when we were children.
So butterflies are disappearing because of habitat loss. The reason we're seeing more swallowtails is because of climate change. And there's a lot of global data showing how butterflies are responding to the change in climate.
In Europe, they've noticed different species of butterflies expanding their range north.
Regina Rochefort is a retired National Park Service scientist.
California has a very long-term study and has shown butterflies moving up in elevation.
In the Pacific Northwest, though, there's no long-term butterfly survey. So Rochefort decided to take matters into her own hands. For the past 8 summers, she's asked volunteers to help her count butterflies in the North Cascades and at Mount Rainier. Sauk Mountain's exposed slopes are covered with grasses, wildflowers, and insects. That makes it the perfect place in the North Cascades to learn how to count butterflies. Riley Gabriel is doing the teaching. She says, first, to imagine a 5-meter by 5-meter box in front of you.
Any butterfly that flies through that box, that is on vegetation on either side of the trail, that is on the trail in front of you, you want to count that butterfly.
Gabriel says one of the keys to accurately counting butterflies is to walk very slowly.
We call it the bridal march. It's like this kind of.
Another pro tip, try not to hit your fellow citizen scientists with the butterfly net.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You're okay.
Despite the hiccups, the volunteers on Sauk Mountain do eventually catch a butterfly.
Yeah, got it.
Got it.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Got it.
First one.
Regina Rochefort is still looking for more butterfly counting volunteers. And David James adds, those who can't make it to the mountains can help too.
We can take hope from the swallowtail.
People can plant butterfly gardens to help provide food for some of the species that aren't swallowtails.
If they have those things, they're going to do okay.
On Sauk Mountain, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Lauren Weedman doesn't live here anymore. She did. She was a writer and actor here, and she moved to L.A. to work in TV and film. She's back, though, this summer with a show called Lauren Weedman Doesn't Live Here Anymore. It's kind of a country music variety show, part hee-haw, part monologue about Lauren's life, including the fact that she was born in West Virginia and then given up for adoption. That connection to Appalachia continues to dawn on her.
I knew I was adopted. I didn't just find that out. My parents weren't just like, oh, sorry, God, I meant to tell you.
Even I knew you were adopted.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the T-shirts help, you know. So I found out that my birth mother and birth father were both allowed to choose a name, which seems very cruel. And I don't know. This is what they told me, or my birth mother told me, that she goes, we could choose a name for some paperwork. And so I called, you know, she's like the guy that, you know, that helped me make you. And they both chose a name, and she had chose Tammy, and he chose Lisa. And when I found that out, it was right during the time period of, like, I not only was going through my second divorce, that had happened, and my dentist was telling me how if I don't get braces on my, like, adult braces, that my profound overjut, that my buck teeth are just going to sort of, you know, scrape away the world. It'd be
just going to take over.
Exactly. He's like, you have to take care of that. And I was like, oh, my, I'm finding out that I'm Tammy Lisa. And in my mind, I'm like, I've tried to keep her inside. I was adopted in, you know, Lauren Huntington Weedman. But then eventually my life has turned more and more into, like, Tammy Lisa. And hearing myself talk, I'm like, my boyfriend's going to come pick me up. He's been so good to my kid. It came to me one morning, too, when I was listening to country music. I go, you guys, if you're going to make nachos, you got to soak the plate, okay? Like, I'm so tired of scraping cheese off plates. And I'm like, what's happened to me? Not that there's anything wrong with that. And I got my DNA thing done, and I'm like, directly, it was like from France, and plop, Appalachia.
When you heard West Virginia,
yeah,
your mind went where?
To Loretta Lynn.
Yeah.
And I think I've kind of fought it because of this prejudice against country music a bit. And then I realized I wrote out at one point, I was doing a writing exercise, and I was writing down all the things I associate with country music. And I realized the negative things I associated with are my fears about myself. Where I'd be like, and I won't even say them because I've tried to put them in the show and I was told it was offensive. So
you could tell me, though.
You know, I'm scared people get mad. If I was like, my prejudice against it, and I know it's not true, is like that it's not as poetic as regular music, right? Mm-hmm. It's too direct. You know, it's like, I came home, I sat down, and then I drank my beer. But it's comforting sometimes to have that kind of directness.
Okay.
You know, like, don't give me a poem right now. I just want to know what's going to happen for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
That, and also thinking, like, this is the one that I feel like, well, people are country music stars if they're not pretty enough to be regular music stars. So you just have to be country music.
I see.
So that's ridiculous. But it's my own thing of, like, there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
Okay, this is going to get me in a million times trouble. I hear myself as I'm saying it.
I'm going to tell you right now, I have prejudices.
Yeah.
I have reactions. You're telling me about a reaction.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Like, okay. A prejudice I thought I had, and then I realized it's also because of my own fear of myself.
Yeah.
And the lack of poetry. My biggest thing, I've always been frustrated about my writing, is I'm like, there's no poetry. I just tell it. And then I realized, just like, I'll complain about Jerry Springer, but sitting next to me on a bus may feel like the same thing. You know, I don't know. Like, what makes me so different?
So you kind of see yourself in that. I'm a country music song.
Yeah. And I was really hoping I would be more of, like, you know, Radiohead,
mm-hmm.
like something more, and I would hang with that crowd. And then when I'm, you know, the fact I'm from Indiana, and then even the men I was dating are a lot of Southerners. One of them from Louisiana has, like, the Southern deficit disorder thing about thinking, he assumes that people are prejudiced against him.
Southern deficit disorder.
Yeah, like he has this sort of insecurity of, like, oh, I guess everybody thinks I'm dumb because of my accent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, I thought that was a selling point. But now that you mention it. So yeah, the country music is from there, and because I was listening to it so much.
Did you grow up with country music?
No, yeah. Not at all.
Oh, really?
Not at all. No, my parents were like symphony.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not, and I never
listened. I kind of pictured like little Lauren soaking that up.
Oh, totally on the farm, just like, why do I have to milk every morning, Mama? I'll just do the mending. No, I was not around that. In fact, when I got into music, was so not into country music, mm-hmm. it was to hate it,
right.
Especially in Indiana. You have to be, you know, be like, no, not me, man. And then I discovered it when I was living in Amsterdam, Willie Nelson, and I was way into that.
Mm-hmm.
And never got into the women until I've gone through 9 divorces. I mean, 15 divorces. I forget. I'm so busy.
Uh-huh.
But then I was really like, this is some, like, women putting it out there in a way, even with the singer-songwriters I like, don't feel as sort of gutsy sometimes, is what I was getting from the women, songwriting women. Mm-hmm. And I could get all of my stuff out. But then eventually I felt like, okay, once the, you know, sadness lifts, I want to start writing again. And write my own songs. And so I've been starting to do that now, which nobody really cares about that besides, well, I can't even think of anybody.
So Tammy Lisa was your birth name,
that
briefly,
yeah.
Or would have been.
Yeah, if they would have kept me, I would have been Tammy Lisa, or maybe Lisa Tammy. Mix it up for the holidays. Yeah.
And then how did you go from that to this show?
Well, I was trying to come up with a way to tell an autobiographical tale without divulging too many personal details because of being a mother and feeling like it was too salacious. In fact, when the second marriage ended, I remember somebody said to me, I can't believe that it's been such a dramatic divorce when he knows you write about your life. Like, he goes,
well, you think you'd have to follow the straight and narrow because I'm with Weedman. It's bad. It's going to be publicly bad.
That's what he's basically saying, you know, because he'd had this, you know, it ended very, you know, dramatically and stuff. And I'm so, like, reticent to get into details about it. But though I do on stage.
You do in the show.
Yeah. And then it's written about other times. I'm always like, I don't want to talk about it, but please come see my musical.
Right. Please see the following works.
Yeah. It's just hypocritical. I don't know why I'm as hypocritical about that. So I came up with the idea of, like, I'll have Tammy Lisa do it. It'll be the Tammy Lisa show. And she'll be this messed up woman. I'll get to tell all the same stories because clearly I can't make up things. I have to always go for my life. I'll just let her do it. And then I did that. And then it still felt like at a certain point I wanted to be able to bust out and be like, that's me hiding behind her because I'm too wimpy to get revenge full on. And I'm too wimpy to be too angry because I'm scared that it'll just break me, that the anger will be too much and I'll be devastated by it. So I think I'll just let Tammy do it. So that's the Tammy Lisa kind of, she's me basically.
One of the songs you picked, wow, I didn't know this Lucinda Williams song, Sweet
Side.
Yeah.
You had the blues ever since you were 6, your little tennis shoes and your pickup sticks. You were screamed at and kicked over and over. Now you always feel sick and you can't keep up.
How'd you come to that song?
It's so hard. It's also personal. It's like when I first heard it, she writes about such broken folks with such love. Like, and I remember thinking, like, yeah, I've got this, you know, was married to a man. They're like, yeah, he's pretty, he's had his rough times. But you know what? You just love me anyway. Like, I've seen it. Because I'd been very attracted to people's sadness. Dated a lot of guys like that. And to the point where I had a therapist go, you should maybe just be, maybe get into social work.
get that'll that be your avenue.
Yeah,
for that.
Like take care of that. You don't have to be dating the people you're taking. Like you could, and I know this all. It's so at 50, it all seems. Hearing myself talk about it, I'm like, why didn't I stop? Because it's exhausting and it didn't work out. But I thought it was. I thought she was so wonderful in how she wrote about it. Yeah, and also like, yes, I've seen this awful part of you, but I know you're good. And it breaks my heart, the song, because it's just like, it just sounds like someone like, I know you're tired. I know you did that. I know he didn't mean, he threw up, and, you know, he was so drunk last night. But I'll tell you what, he just, like in the show, I'm like, he's gluten intolerant. Poor guy.
Yeah.
And now I find it like more like, oh, like tragic to listen to. Like, oh, come on. Like his sweet side, like, shut up. Like,
I can save this.
Yes.
You're not going to hurt me.
Listen, that was my OK Cupid profile right there, basically. If you're stuck in a moment and you can't get out of it, and you know, and if your mother moved four times after her divorce and it really screwed you up, I'm your lady. I'm trying to get away from that.
Yes.
Did I answer any question? I feel like I just, I mean, it's not my, I'm not being paid. I don't care. Never mind.
Is your show, it's called Lauren Weedman Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Is it going to be called that everywhere you go, or is that that is only a Seattle title? Because you can't go to Lauren Weedman also doesn't live in Midland.
They actually changed it for Seattle. Like it was commissioned by Portland Center Stage, and it was called Lauren Weedman Doesn't Live Here. And then here, they added Anymore.
Yeah.
On it. And the title, I'm not that, like, I don't like having my name in a title. There's something
you
about,
don't?
I don't, does that seem...
Because you're so shy.
Yeah, it's not
so
about
modest.
Me.
It's not about you.
Yeah, I'm...
A one-woman show.
Yeah, don't look at me. I don't want everybody staring at me at once. About tickets. I want to hear all about me. It's heavy carrying that mirror all the time. No, I don't, I guess because when I tell people about it, like, what's it called? I'm like, Lauren Weedman. And like, I don't know, it just feels like, I mean, I like the title. I'm not going to be disrespectful to the people who titled it. I didn't come up with the title, so
okay.
I like to be a victim whenever I can.
Yes.
You know, like, oh, makes me feel feminine. Not that that's a feminine. Oh, God. It's hard to
get. Can't win.
You really can't.
You're in Seattle now.
I know. Listen, Portland got me ready for it because I got a lot of emails after the Portland show where people are like, I loved it, actually. I like getting these now because it used to always throw me. But like, dear Lauren, I laughed a lot during your show and I loved your energy. But I have to say, your jokes about menopause did not go over well with my group of 50-year-old women that I was with. Menopause is a joyous time. And but there's much comedy to be found in it, but not in the way you were talking about it. Sand does not pour out of us. Yeah, and I had all those, you know, people being sensitive to things, which I can appreciate.
Are you missing Seattle?
Yes.
Be honest, though.
Oh, God, yes.
L.A., Seattle.
L.A., Seattle. Let's see. Let me have a meeting about it. I'm done. Yeah, Seattle, for sure. Just for people. For life. You know, it'd be wonderful.
To me, you're Seattle, but you were only here for like 5 years or something,
I think,
right?
It's IMBD, because IMBD has on there, like, my bio says I'm from Seattle. Uh-huh. And that's how I know people only know me from my IMBD, because they'll be like, so, I mean, you grew up in Seattle? And I'm like, did your research?
Speaking of your Seattle theater career, have you heard about the Showbox?
No, they, what?
The property developer wants to destroy it and put a high-rise on the Showbox.
That is so upsetting to hear that, and it's upsetting.
Did you ever play the Showbox?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, but there's, what's wrong with, it's like, I can't, it's so upsetting. This getting old thing, I just, where's my rolling pin? Because I just feel like especially in Seattle, I'm staying on Lake Union, and to get from the theater to like where I'm staying is, if, you know, in the car with there's no traffic, it'd be like 5 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But it is like, the city is huge. I mean, everything's gotten like totally, I don't understand, like, actually what's everybody doing? And people don't know how to walk on sidewalks too. I'm like, you've gotten too big. You're not ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's so
we haven't grown into
exactly.
Our feet yet.
It feels like that.
Like,
I feel
a big
like
puppy.
Yeah, because I feel like New York City. It was so busy, congested down there, like on the sidewalks and stuff. Where mm-hmm. I'm like, you guys, you know how to get to the side, right? If you're gonna have this many people, we gotta have a meeting. It's intense, you know. Like, yet there's a lot of good restaurants. So I don't. Why don't they stop it? Why can't they stop the Showbox?
They might preserve the Showbox. It just has to go through a bunch of landmark preservation board meetings and votes and things. But it might not go away.
I hope so. It's like, come on, y'all. I mean, I can see getting rid of the NEA. I'm just kidding. But the Showbox. No, it's so upsetting. It makes me just want to do a show about myself and sing songs. Basically, all I wanted, the most comforting thing after the divorce and even now, is just sitting around playing music. Music has been so comforting during this time period. You know, and learning how to play guitar has been so nice. Even though I've been so resistant, like, God, I don't want to be up there on stage like, oh, look, who endowed her with she can do anything? As if, like, I was on TV once, and now I know I can do anything I want. I'm a ballet dancer now. Watch me, everybody. Because in L.A., sometimes actors will be like, I'm a rock star now.
Yes.
And you're like, saying it doesn't make it so. Or maybe it does, actually. I haven't read that book.
Lauren Weedman, who doesn't live here anymore.
Oh.
ACT Theater till when?
Until August 12th, I think. 13th.
Unless it gets extended.
I don't think it'll be extended.
Lauren Weedman does live here again.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I'm looking for some reason I have to get stuck here. But I don't want it to be medical.
Okay.
In case the universe was listening there. I hope I said that quickly enough. I'd like to be trapped here, but not because of broken bones.
Thanks for tuning into The Record on KUOW Seattle. That was Lauren Weedman. You know, the record's produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, she's a science fiction writer, and she's the chief information officer for the city of Kirkland. She's Brenda Cooper, and she joins us tomorrow on The Record.